Welcome to Supernatural podcast number, episode number 16 for Scarecrow, which originally aired in the U.S. on January 10th, 2006, and also for Faith, which aired on January 17th, 2006. Since I've been moving cross-country this past week, and since I didn't have access to internet to work on my episodes, I decided I'd do a double episode to keep on schedule. You know, it's funny, it was not until my freshman year in college that I first used the internet, but now I feel like I'm living in the Middle Ages, waiting to get the cable man over here to install the cable and internet. It's tortuous. Anyway, let's get started. I am starting something new this week. I'm going to include sound clips from the episodes instead of simply reciting lines. Not only will this be more interesting, since I am not a good actress, and it's hard to read dialogue as one person, but several people have mentioned that they'd like to hear or see clips from the show. I have no intention of turning this into a video podcast, but I think I could play some short clips without running the risk of copyright infringement. Let me know what you think of the new format. I have a couple news tidbits for you. Did you know that Supernatural is up for a few awards the next month? For the Teen Choice Awards, Jensen is nominated for TV Choice Breakout Actor and the show for TV Choice Breakout Show. The show is on August 20th on Fox. If you're between the ages of 13 and 19, you can go to the site and vote for your favorites. Also, the Primetime Emmy nominations were announced, and Supernatural is nominated for two. The categories are Outstanding Music Composition for a Series for the Pilot and Outstanding Sound Editing for a Series from the Pilot. The 58th Annual Primetime Emmy Awards show will be on August 27th on NBC. So, this is episode part one, the review of Scarecrow. It opens in Burkittsville, Indiana, 1 year ago. A young couple is leaving a diner with an apple pie that's been given to them for the road. They had been lost, and everyone in the town has been super nice to them. When the old man shakes the younger man's hand, a young girl from town comments on his tattoo. On the way out of town, their car dies, and they cannot get any cell coverage. When they get out to find a nearby house, they come across a creepy-looking scarecrow. As they walk away, the girl sees the scarecrow's head turned towards her. Strange noises, and then we are treated to Blair Witch-like camera work as they run through the orchard. As they are killed, we see that the scarecrow has abandoned the cross he was on. Cuts to a motel room, and we see that this is a continuation from Sam answering the phone at the end of Asylum. It's Dad on the line, and he will not tell Sam where he is, but he is closing in on the ceiling demon. And yes, it is a demon. John says, "Look, we do not have time for this. This is bigger than you think. They are everywhere. Even us talking right now, it is not safe." Dean takes the phone from Sam and jots down the information John gives him. So it cuts to the metallic car at night. The names are couples who were road tripping and disappeared, never to be heard from again. They all disappeared in the same part of Indiana on the second week in April. Coincidence?
So Dad is sending us to Indiana to go hunting for something before another couple vanishes?
Yahtzee.
But angsty Sam does not want to go to Indiana. He wants to go to California. Dad called from a payphone in the Sacramento area code. Sam does not want to follow orders anymore. Once again, the same argument we saw in Asylum and throughout the season, and Dean says it's called being a good son to follow Dad's orders. Dean storms out of the car and follows Sam. Sam is gathering his stuff to leave, and Dean tells him that he's being selfish. Sam trots off on foot towards California, and Dean drives away towards Indiana. Now, this is a very important part, the separation, because it sets up two different storylines, and it's finally the showdown that we've been anticipating. As Dean pulls into town, he picks up his cell to dial Sam, but does not make the call. Instead, he heads through the rain to Scotty's cafe. Dean introduces himself to Scotty as John Bonham. Scotty replies, "Isn't that the drummer for Led Zeppelin?" Dean, a bit startled, says, "Wow, yeah, a classic rock fan." He asks Scotty if he has seen a couple missing people and shows him the photos of the recently disappeared couple. So cuts to Sam on the road alone. It is here that we meet Meg.
So where are you headed?
No offense, but no way I'm telling you.
Why not?
You could be some kind of freak. I mean, you are hitchhiking.
Well, so are you.
Need a ride?
Yeah.
Just her. I ain't taking you.
Trust shady van guy and not me?
Definitely.
So Dean asks the people that we saw give the young couple the apple pie, and they say they do not remember the couple. But the young girl, Emily, does, and asks Dean if the man had a tattoo. Yes, he replies. She says they were just married, and the man tells Dean that they stopped for gas for 10 minutes, and he pointed them in the way of the interstate. Dean goes to investigate. In his bag on the back seat, his EMF reader starts making sounds, so Dean pulls over to check it out. And here we are treated to one of my top 10 lines of the season.
Dude, you fugly.
Dean notices the scarecrow has a hook in his right hand and a tattoo on his arm that matches that of the last victim. So Dean goes to the service station to fill up the car, and the same girl is there. She says it is a nice town and that they are blessed, for all the other towns nearby are having financial difficulties. And you know what? There is a couple at the station with car troubles. Meanwhile, at the bus terminal...
Sorry, the Sacramento bus doesn't run again until tomorrow. 5:05 p.m.
Tomorrow? There's got to be another way.
Well, there is. Buy a car.
Sam is about to dial Dean's cell, but he sees Meg there. Back at the cafe, they are feeding the couple apple pie, and Dean talks to them. The mechanic saved their lives by finding a leaking brake line and fixing it for them. Scotty called the sheriff, who proceeds to run Dean out of town. It cuts to Sam and Meg having some beers and chatting. Sam asks her if she's on vacation. Yeah, right. It is all sipping Cristal poolside. Meg tells Sam, because my family said so, I'm supposed to sit there and do as I am told. So I just went in my own way instead. It's like she is channeling his thoughts or something. And this scene is very relevant when put into the context of Meg's role with the ceiling demon in the rest of the season. I've thought about this episode a lot when considering who and what Meg was. More on that later. Sam tells Meg that he agrees with her, since he has been going through the same thing with his brother.
Here's to us. The food might be bad, and the beds might be hard, but at least we're living our own lives. And nobody else's.
So it cuts to the young couple following the same routine as the one last year, and once more the scarecrow's on the loose. But this time, Dean is headed back into town and shows up and tells the couple to go back to their car. He shoots rock salt at the scarecrow, cocks the gun on the run, and shoots. But the scarecrow is not deterred from his hunt. But once they arrive at the car, the scarecrow is gone. So it cuts to the next morning, and Meg is asleep. Sam is on the phone with Dean, who tells him about the scarecrow. I can't cope without you, you know, he tells Sam. Dean thinks that it's a pagan god who's animating the scarecrow. Since the sacrificial people are a man and woman, it appears to be some kind of fertility rite, and the cycle is annual. Dean is headed to a community college to talk to a professor to dig up some information on the pagan god. Dean says, since I do not have my trusty sidekick geek boy to do my research. And Sam replies, you know, if you're hinting that you need my help, just ask. But Dean says, Sam, you were right. You have to do your own thing. You have to live your own life. You've always known what you want, and you go after it. Dean tells him that he's proud of him, and Sam is speechless. So Dean is talking with the professor about pagan worship in Indiana. And he says, what if it was imported, like the pilgrims brought their religion over? Wasn't a lot of this area settled by immigrants? Like that town near here, Burkittsville, where are their ancestors from? The professor says that they were from Northern Europe, Scandinavia. And Dean replies, tell me about those. The professor says, there were hundreds of Norse gods and goddesses. The professor takes out an old book and they look through it. They come across a scarecrow and Dean stops him. The Vanir were Norse gods of protection and prosperity, keeping the local people safe from harm. Effigies were constructed, and some people practiced sacrifice with one male and one female. Many believe that there was a sacred tree. As Dean is leaving, he is knocked unconscious by the sheriff. So we see three people huddled under umbrellas talking about their responsibility to protect the town. The scene is very reminiscent from the film The Village when the elders were discussing the future of the town. Tonight is the last night of the cycle, and they have already noticed that the trees are beginning to die. The older man we met earlier on is hesitant. He feels that what they're going to do is murder. Dean and the young girl from before, Emily, are to be sacrificed. And she is put into the cellar and locked in. The girl says, why are you doing this? She cries to her aunt and uncle, for the common good. So back in the bus station, the bus has finally arrived. But Sam is worried that Dean is not answering the cell. It's not like him. Meg begs Sam to come with her to California, but Sam is going to find Dean and make sure he's okay. So it cuts to Dean trying to get out of the cellar. Emily says that they are going to kill them. Dean replies, sacrifice us, which is classier, I guess. Dean asks her about old trees, and she said that there is a really old apple tree that the immigrants brought over with them, and they call it the first tree. The locals come to get them and take them to the orchard where they tie them up.
Hope your apple pie is freaking worth it!
So Emily asks Dean, what's the plan? He says, I'm working on it. So it gets dark, and once again, she asks if he has another plan, and Dean says, I'm working on it. But just then, Sam arrives and unties Dean.
Come on. How'd you get here?
I stole a car.
That's my boy. Keep an eye on that scarecrow. He could come alive any minute.
What scarecrow?
So they run through the orchard trying to find the first tree. They run into the locals and are cornered. Emily's uncle is attacked and dragged off with her aunt by the scarecrow, but they manage to avoid him all night. And the next morning they find the tree. Sam pours lighter fluid onto it and Dean makes a torch. Emily lights the tree. Bye-bye, sacred tree. So cuts to the bus station again, and Emily is getting on a bus bound for Boston. Dean asks Sam if he can drop him off somewhere, and he says no. Jess and Mom, they are both gone. Dad is God knows where. You and me, that's all that's left. If we are going to see this through, we are going to do it together, Sam says. Uncomfortable with sentimental moments, in classic Dean fashion, he says, hold me, Sam, that was beautiful. So Bad Company starts to play, and we see Meg in a van with another shady guy. She pulls out a large bowl with faces imprinted on the edges. I've got to make a call, Meg says. I've got a cell phone you can use, he says. It's not that kind of call, she replies, slits the man's throat and puts the bowl under to catch the blood. She looks in the bowl, swirls her finger in the blood, and recites some Latin. She asks why they let Sam and Dean go, that she could have taken them both. Yes, father, she says to the blood. And that's the end of the episode. So let's move on to the analysis. I know the recap was very detailed, but it's for good reason. First, this episode is why I love the show, and one of the best in my opinion. There was a lot of plot development in the episode to make up for the last few, which are primarily self-contained. Dad makes contact with the boys, their differences finally come to a head, we meet Meg, and find out she is mixed up with demons. Not to mention the baddie of the week. It was beautifully shot with a great storyline to intertwine all the other stuff going on. The part at the end left me in an awe as I sat on the edge of my seat, interested to see where it was going. I have come back to this episode over and over in my head when trying to figure out the clues Kripke has given us about the ceiling demon, how he chooses victims and children, and who Meg is, and Demon Jr. were at the end of the season. Now let's talk a little bit more about Meg. Is the family she is running away from mortal or supernatural? Escaping her family, telling her what to do, so she ran away? Meg calls the demon father. But who is on the other end of the call? We can guess by the timeline and her behaviors that she was already possessed at this point. Was she sent there to do something specific with Sam and Dean? Spy on them? Try to entice Sam to leave with her? Something else? We know she was meant to let them go, but not kill them. But why? This episode felt like a combination of Tim Burton's Sleepy Hollow and M. Night Shyamalan's The Village. The mood and cinematography is reminiscent of Sleepy Hollow, and the suspense and characters are reminiscent of The Village. There was only one continuity issue that I could find. According to the dialogue, we know that the episode takes place during the second week of April. However, there are ripe apples all over the Scarecrow's orchard, as well as fallen autumn leaves, which would indicate that this episode takes place during the autumn. Burkittsville, Indiana may be a reference to Burkittsville, Maryland, the town where the film The Blair Witch Project took place, and even some of the camera work was reminiscent of The Blair Witch Project. So I love the nods that they do to all the pop culture stuff. So let's move on to the legends and references. The first and most obvious, of course, is the Scarecrow. There are few films that feature scarecrows in any sort of interactive way. Of course, there's The Wizard of Oz, and although also a fantasy, that one is not malicious. Sleepy Hollow had a scarecrow meant to set the scene of a dark and scary place, but was not alive. Finally, the baddie in Jeepers Creepers was rather scarecrow-like in behavior and somewhat in look, except for the flying bit. I really do not want to mention the couple of B-horror movie films that I found out about scarecrows, such as Scarecrow's Gone Wild from 2004. Now, scarecrows are used as a symbol, as a Jungian archetype and spiritual symbol in psychology. A scarecrow is a dimension of the Jungian archetype commonly known as the shadow. Scarecrows represent monstrous emotions and thoughts, which often provoke feelings of dread and fear. Scarecrows were used during harvesting rituals of early tribes, such as those for the autumn equinox. The second reference are that of Norse gods, the Vanir. Now, the Norse gods are of three different types. There's the Aesir, the gods of the tribe or clan, representing kingship, order, craft, etc., including Odin and Thor. Two, the Vanir, gods of the fertility of earth and forces of nature, including Freyr and Freyja, and I'm just absolutely killing these Nordic words. The third is Jotnar. They're giant gods who are in constant state of war with the Æsir, representing chaos and destruction. The Vanir are gods of fertility, the sea, and prosperity. While the Æsir are war gods, the Vanir were understood to be rich, the giver of riches, the patrons of fecundity, pleasure, peace, and with the Æsir, the bringers of unity. In the old Germanic religion, the central practice was animal and human sacrifice conducted in the open or in groves and forests. Roman authors repeatedly mention the sacrifice of prisoners of war to the gods of victory. One detailed description of a sacrificial feast is given in a saga about a king of Norway, in which cattle were slaughtered, blood was sprinkled inside and out, the meat was consumed, and toasts were drunk to Odin, Njord, and Freyr. Sacrifices of a more private kind include the sacrifice of an ox to a god or smearing an elf mound with bull's blood. Another mention they had was the sacred tree. And in Norse myth, Iduna was the keeper of the apples of immortality, which kept the gods young. The fruit-bearing tree is referred to by Tacitus in his description of Norse runic divination, may have been the apple. Apple indicates choice and is useful for love and healing magic. And we saw apples on the ground in the episode. Now, let's move on to the Great World Tree. And it's difficult to pronounce, but I believe it's Yggdrasil. It's part of Norse mythology and literally is the central part, as this ash tree is believed to grow up through all of the various worlds connecting them. The name is translated to mean terrible steed, although sometimes also called Odin's steed or Odin's horse. The tree is associated with Odin because the god hung from the branches for 9 days in order to learn the mysteries of the runes. There are three roots to the tree, and under each of the roots is one of the mythological worlds: Asgard, Niflheim, or Hel, and Jotunheim. The trunk of the tree runs through the realm of man, Midgard. The tree is not simply a supporting structure for these worlds. There are other landmarks and inhabitants as well. Under each of the roots is a sacred well, one of which is tended by the Norns. These three women control time and destiny by weaving threads, much like the three fates of Greek myth. They also water the roots of Yggdrasil with the water from that well. There are also several animals that live there: a bird, a rooster, eagle, living among the branches, a dragon that chews the roots, a squirrel that runs up and down the tree with messages between them. 4 deer or stags are also living in the branches of the great tree, representing the 4 directions. At Ragnarok, Sutir, leader of the fire giants, will set fire to the tree and bring about the end of the world. 2 humans, Lif and Lifthrasir, will survive the destruction by hiding among the branches of Yggdrasil and will populate the world after this battle of the gods. So that leads us to some songs. There were 2 songs in the episode. One is Bad Company by Bad Company. Love how they named a song after their own band name, although I love the song. And Lodi by Creedence Clearwater Revival. Now, as for the song of the night tonight, I'm really excited about this song. It's by my favorite band. The song is called The Way Down. It's by Modest Mouse, and it's brought to you by K Records. Enjoy.
On the way down, they saw got there. If you wanted them down, you could just pull on the lever and say, I'm hung up on this decade. They found themselves on schools and on the halls. They created pages to collect on their catalogs. Well, what's mine is mine, and what's yours, and we all.
Move on to episode part two. It's a review of Faith. So let's go right into the recap. It opens as Sam and Dean drive up to a rundown house in some unnamed town. They load up on weapons and Dean says that he wants this raw head extra crispy and that they will only get one shot at it. They head down into the basement and hear a noise. Breaking into a closet, they find two young children, a sister and brother. They confirm that the monster is still there and Dean takes a shot with the flare gun and misses. Sam rushes to get the kids out of the house, and Dean confronts the creature again. The baddie knocks Dean into a puddle, and Dean shoots the creature and makes contact, but the electricity runs through the water and electrocutes Dean in the process. Sam runs down the stairs and finds Dean unconscious. So, it's an exciting opening scene. It cuts to a hospital, and Sam hands a credit card to the nurse for payment of the hospital, and the name is Mr. Berkowitz. I believe this is a reference of David Berkowitz, a serial killer known as the Son of Sam. She gives a report to the police that they were driving by and had the windows down. They heard screams from the house and stopped, wherein they found the children in the basement. Then Sam meets the doctor, who tells Sam that the electrocution triggered a massive heart attack, and they give Dean a couple weeks to a month to live. Now, I give props to Jared in this scene. He really proves that he can do a great acting job. I feel his sorrow and pain in that moment, not to mention my own worry for Dean the first time I watched the episode. So he goes into seeing Dean, who looks terrible, and says, have you ever really watched daytime TV? It's terrible. Dean ignores Sam's attempt to discuss his medical condition, continuing, that fabric softener teddy bear. Ooh, I'm going to hunt that little bitch down. Dean has accepted that he is going to die, but Sam refuses to accept Dean's fate.
All right, well, looks like you're going to leave town without me.
What are you talking about? I'm not going to leave you here.
Hey, you better take care of that car. I swear I'll haunt your ass.
I don't think that's funny.
Ah, oh, come on, it's a little funny.
So it cuts to a motel room and Sam is making calls. There's medical information all around him and Sam leaves a message for Dad. Just then, there's a knock at the door. Guess who it is? Dean. He checked himself out of the hospital. There weren't any cute nurses there. Sam spent the last 3 days scouring the internet and calling Dad's contacts in the journal. Joshua told him about a specialist in Nebraska that can help Dean. So they get out of the car and Dean sees who Sam brought him to, the Church of Roy LaGrange, a faith healer. Dean is extremely skeptical and they pass a protester who claims that Roy is a fraud. Sam tells him to have a little faith and then they meet Layla, a young woman who is with her mother, and they go to the service. Yeah, peace, love, and trust all over, Dean says, nodding to a security camera. So Sam makes Dean sit up front under great protest and the service begins. Sam notices some symbols on the altar, and Roy says that God helps him heal by looking into people's hearts. Dean mutters, yeah, and into their wallets. Roy, a blind man, has excellent hearing and confronts Dean on it. Roy tells Dean to join him on the stage. Wild cheering and applause. Dean is reluctant, saying that he should choose someone else. Dean is always the martyr. Sam makes him go up on stage.
You ready?
Yeah, look, no disrespect. Exactly, a believer.
You will be, son. You will be. Pray with me, friends.
So then Dean is healed, and when he comes to, he sees a strange man standing behind Roy, who then vanishes. So Dean goes to the hospital, and all his tests come back perfect. In fact, it shows no damage on his heart whatsoever. The doctor tells them it's strange, a 27-year-old man dropped dead from a heart attack the previous day. Healthy, athletic. Dean is concerned, and he can't shake a feeling he has. When I was healed, I just felt wrong, felt cold, and for a second I saw someone, an old man. I tell you, it was a spirit. And Dean wants to investigate it. So he's off to see the minister, and Sam is to look into the heart attack victim. Dean asks Roy why him, and Roy replies because he is a young man with an important purpose, a job to do, and it isn't finished. Sam found out about Marshall, the man who died, and who thought someone was chasing him. But, like Dean, no one else could see it. As Dean was leaving Roy's, he ran into Layla and her mom. Layla's mommy confronts Dean about his being healed, and he is a non-believer. And Dean continues to feel worse about his being healed instead of another person, particularly after he finds out about Layla's brain tumor. So back at the motel, Sam tells Dean the bad news that Marshall died at the exact same time that Dean was healed. This has happened 6 times in the past year.
Sorry about what?
Marshall Hall died at 4:17.
The exact time I was healed.
Yeah. So I put together a list, everyone Roy's healed, 6 people over the past year, and I cross-checked them with the local obits. Every time someone was healed, someone else died. And each time the victim died of the same symptom LaGrange was healing at the time.
Someone's healed of cancer, someone else dies of cancer.
Somehow, LaGrange is trading a life for another.
Dean is angry because someone died to save him, and Sam feels really sorry. We see clips of other healings where a girl dies to save an old man, and we understand how it works. LaGrange is dealing with a Reaper. Dean does not want to believe it, but he knew deep down that it was a Reaper when he saw it. They talk about Reapers, blah, 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 and wonder how Roy is controlling it. The symbol Sam saw in the church was on the Death Tarot card. If Roy is using magic to control the Reaper, Sam says, that's like putting a dog leash on a great white. So it cuts to Sam and Dean going to Roy's service. Sam goes to Roy's house to find a book or something that he might be using, and Dean goes to wait for the service to start for about 15 minutes. Sam finds a magic book, and there are articles about people who they find immoral. The man outside the service who was protesting Roy's church as a cult may be the next on the list. So Layla is chosen for healing. That puts Dean in a tight situation. And Sam is outside in the parking lot looking for Wright, the protester. Just then, he screams, "Help!" And we see him being chased by a Reaper. Of course, Sam can't see it. Dean yells fire and everyone evacuates, but Roy is not controlling the Reaper. It is his wife, Sue Ann. Dean catches Sue Ann in the act, and she calls for the police to have him evacuated.
We'll catch you around here again, son. We'll put the fear of God in you, understand?
Yes, sir. Fear of God. Got it.
We find out that Roy is performing a special service, a private service, that night for Layla. So they go to the house and church next door to each other and split up to find Roy's wife. Sam goes into the basement and finds the altar. He meets Sue Ann, who thinks that this is her reward from God to reward the good and punish the wicked. Dean is meant to be the next victim. Just as Roy starts to heal Layla and Dean is killed by the Reaper, Sam smashes Sue Ann's cross with blood in it. The Reaper smiles, oh, I love that part, and kills Sue Ann, and the boys leave. So it cuts to the motel room, and Layla arrives because Sam called her, and Sam leaves them so they can talk. Layla says she is okay with dying since she has her faith. Dean, who professes to not being one to pray, says he will pray for her, and she says that that's a miracle. So let's move on to the analysis. The first thing I have to mention is just tonight I watched an episode on House. It's called House versus God or something like that. It's about this 15-year-old boy who's a faith healer. And I've never seen House before, but I had heard from a friend that the episode is about faith healing, so I turned it on, and it was a very skeptical episode. It was interesting that they two shows dealt with faith healing this season, because it's not a very popular topic, but I like how they both dealt with it. In the end, they turned out both to be frauds, or, you know, there's some sort of supernatural element, but it wasn't necessarily, you know, God running the show, but it really brings up a lot of those, you know, faith versus medicine, or, you know, what can be proved and what can't be proved, and whether you're on the side that, you believe in faith healing or you don't. I won't get into that, but it's just interesting. Anytime you bring up a philosophical discussion like that, I think it, you know, by thinking through something, it it just expands your boundaries, and I think it's great. So when Dean saw the Reaper, but Sam could not see it, Sam made a big deal out of not being able to see it, since he is the psychic person after all. In fact, Sam threw kind of a tantrum about not believing Dean about the spirit. Dean turned the tables on him, saying that he needs to have faith. What is up with all the skepticism in this episode? I mean, I know it's, you know, faith and all of these things are really touchy, but come on, Sam, get over it. For once, you do not have the special gift, and let Dean have his little bit of moment of glory here. What really bothered me was that they don't tell you where Sam and Dean were at the beginning of the episode, nor did they talk about the baddie they fought. I had to do some serious research to find information about Bloody Bones, a.k.a. Rawhead. I'll talk about Bloody Bones in a moment. Overall, I liked the episode a lot. I was excited to have a Reaper on the show, but I did not like the episode as much as the first time through, or as much the first time through as I did on the rewatch. I think it was a lot more interesting the second time around. I like how they played up Dean's guilt and how he shows attachment to people, and that is perhaps why he does not get close to anyone except his family. I know the feeling, actually. I have a lot of acquaintances but few close friends because I do not like to lose those close to me. It's better to stay away than to get emotionally invested in a relationship and then it ends. I think this may be at the center of Dean's emotional issues, but I did not get that feeling until the rewatch, so I think it was definitely worth the second time through. I think it was interesting, and there were enough twists to keep me interested in the entire program. I like that they did not make the Reaper stereotypical with the black robes and the Sith, kind of like the Showtime program called Dead Like Me that was on for 2 seasons about Reapers who live among us, and that's their job, they're Reapers, and that we don't know them, we don't see them as that. When Dean was in the hospital, he made a comment about how bad daytime television is. Now, this is really funny, since Jensen Ackles got his start on Days of Our Lives, a daytime soap opera. Nice reference. I love it when they stick something personal in there, like we'll see with Hell House in a few weeks. One last thing, and this is big, as it is continuously brought up throughout the season in a subtle manner. Now, what role does religion play in the Winchester family? Sam seems to be more religious than Dean, but it's a specific organized religion or spirituality. Dean makes comments along the lines that he is a complete non-believer, and I personally think he has some spirituality and perhaps even draws from maybe some pagan influences, perhaps Wicca. The entire season is spent talking about demons and supernatural creatures without reference to them practicing religion, just a lot of knowledge about it. As I'll discuss in a later episode, I do not think that all of the beings they cross are Christian, and that Kripke draws from sources around the world. Whatever the specifics, it balances the brothers and does not get preachy in the least, which I love about the series. So let's move on to the legends and references section. Now, there was a lot going on in this episode to talk about here. First, of course, is the Grim Reaper. Death personified is a figure that has existed in mythology and popular culture since the earliest days of storytelling. Because the reality of death has had a substantial influence on the living human psyche and the development of civilization as a whole, the personification of death as a living, sentient entity is a concept that has existed in many societies since the beginning of recorded history. In the United States, death is usually shown as a skeletal figure wearing a midnight black gown with a hood, while in Europe he is depicted similarly but dressed in white, which is the traditional color worn at funerals in many places. I won't go into details about the Reaper in different cultures, but there's plenty of information out there on the web alone. Examples of death personified are, in modern-day European-based folklore, death is known as the Grim Reaper, or Grim Specter of Death. In the Middle Ages, death was imagined as decaying or mummified human corpse, later becoming the familiar skeleton in a robe. Father Time is sometimes said to be death, and a psychopomp is a spirit, deity, or other being whose task is to conduct the souls of the recently dead into the afterlife. Let's talk about tarot, and I'm going to do some, actually quite a bit of background here, because I think it's really interesting, and I'm sure it'll come up again and again in the series. The majority of modern tarot decks consist of 78 cards with allegorical representations today used for divination, that first appeared in medieval times. A typical tarot deck consists of the major arcana, which is 22 trump cards, sometimes referred to as keys, and the minor arcana consisting of 56 cards, sometimes referred to as pips. In the origin category, while the exact source of tarot is not completely known, the most commonly held belief and earliest available reliable information is that tarot originated as a game in 15th century Italy by adding to a normal deck of 21 trump cards a fool and four queens of each suit. Some early tarot decks of northern Italian origin, which date to the early to mid 15th century, have remained. In 1763, Giacomo Casanova wrote in his diary that his Russian mistress frequently used a deck of playing cards for divination. In 1781, Antoine Cour de Gobelin wrote a speculative history and a detailed system for using the tarot to foretell the future. There's no evidence for any tarot cards prior to the hand-painted ones that were used by Italian nobles, but some esoteric schools believe its origins could be in ancient Egypt, ancient India, or even the lost continent of Atlantis. Let's talk about the use of tarot cards in divination. Although much of tarot imagery looks mysterious or exotic to modern users, nearly all of it represents conventional symbolism popular in the late Middle Ages and early Renaissance. Nearly all of it may be easily as interpreted as a reflection of the dominant Christian values of the times. And in fact, a lot of Christians did use tarot decks. Later confusion about the symbolization stems in part from the occult decks, which began a process of steadily paganizing and universalizing the symbolism to the point where the underlying Christian allegory has been somewhat obscured. It is notable that between 1450 and 1500, the tarot was actually recommended for the instruction of the young by church moralists. The tarot deck cards eventually came to be associated with mysticism and magic. This was actually a late rather than early development, as we can tell from period sources on card divination and magic. The tarot was not widely adopted by mystics, occultists, and secret societies until the 18th and 19th century. The tradition began in 1781 when Gobelin published Le Monde Primitif, a speculative study which included religious symbolism and its survivals in the modern world. De Gobelin finally asserted that symbolism of the Tarot de Marseille represented the mysteries of Isis and Thoth. Although tarot decks were used for fortune-telling in Bologna, Italy in the 1700s, they were first widely publicized as a divination method by Aite, also called Itilia, a French occultist. Itilia designed the first esoteric tarot deck, adding astrological attributions and Egyptian motifs to various cards, altering many of them from the Marseille designs and adding divinatory meanings and text on the cards. Now, tarot became increasingly popular beginning in 1910 with the publication of the Rider-Waite-Smith deck, which took the step of including symbolic images related to divinatory meanings on the numeric cards. In the 20th century, a huge number of different decks were created, some traditional, some vastly different. I've seen decks anywhere from cat magic or Harry Potter decks all the way to it was for the dot-com boom in the Bay Area of San Francisco. I mean, it's unbelievable. There's, you know, a little bit of everything. You can find any deck out there, and some are serious and some are more on the humorous side. I personally have Aleister Crowley's Thoth deck, which draws from various traditions and is based on the symbolism of Tarot de Marseille that I mentioned earlier. It focuses on Egyptian and Greek mythology. So let's talk about Bloody Bones. He's also known as Rawhead and Tommy Rawhead, and he's an Irish boogeyman that's said to live in the pipes under the sink and in dark cupboards. He drowns naughty children and rewards the good. He's covered all over with matted hair, has flat blue eyes, and is rumored to have a crouching form like a rock. And that's about all there is to know about Rawhead or Bloody Bones. There's not a lot of information out there. Let's talk about necromancy. It's a form of divination in which the practitioner seeks to summon the spirits of the dead in order to gain knowledge about future events. These spirits are called operative spirits and spirits of divination. So necromancy has been used by ancient peoples as well as today. The historian Strabo refers to necromancy as the principal form of divination among the people of Persia. It's believed to have also had widespread use amongst the people of Chaldea, Etruria, and Babylonia. In the Odyssey, Odysseus makes a voyage to Hades, the underworld, and raises the spirits of the dead using spells he has learned from Circe. His intention was to involve the shade of Tiresias, but he was unable to summon it without the assistance of others. There are also references to necromancy in the Bible. In Deuteronomy, Israelites were warned against the Canaanite practice of divination from the dead. This warning was not always heeded. King Saul asked the witch of Endor to invoke the shade of Samuel, for example. Norse mythology also contains examples of necromancy, such as the scene in the Völuspá, in which Odin summons a seer from the dead to tell him of the future. So, is it still used in modern times? Definitely. Necromancy may or may not have a relation to shamanism, which calls upon spirits such as the ghosts of ancestors. Modern seances, channeling, and spiritualism verge on necromancy when the involved spirits are asked to reveal future events, and necromancy is extensively practiced in voodoo. So let's talk about black magic. Black magic or dark magic is the branch of magic used to perform evil acts or that draws on malevolent powers. In the Inquisition, Christians were afraid of witches practicing black magic. In modern times, witches will use the term to describe the bad magic that they do not do in contrast with the good white magic that they do practice. Black magic may be involved to kill, injure, or cause destruction for personal gain without regard to harmful consequences to others. As a term, black magic is normally used to describe a form of ritual that some people or person does not approve of. Group or person. Not everything that's called black magic truly has malevolent intentions behind it, as I will tell you. The differences between black magic and white magic are debated. Several theories compare and contrast the two branches. These theories include the all-in-one theory, the no-connection theory, and the separate but equal theory. All is one states that all forms of magic are evil or black magic. This view generally associates black magic with Satanism. The religions that maintain this opinion include most branches of Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Buddhism, and Hinduism. Some people in the left-hand path would agree that all magic, whether black or white, is the same. These people would not contend that all magic is evil, as much as that morality is in the eyes of the beholder, that any magic can have both good and bad consequences depending on who judges those consequences. In this school of thought, there is no separation between benevolent and malevolent magic, because there is no universal morality against which magic can be measured. The dark doctrine states that black magic refers to the powers of darkness, usually seen from a left-hand path point of view. This may or may not contrast with white magic, depending on the sorcerer's acceptance of dualism. The formal differences are different, or the forms and components of black magic, due to the different aims or interests of those casting harmful spells than those of white. Harmful spellcasting tends to include symbolism which seems hazardous or harmful to human beings, such as sharp, pointed, prickly, caustic, and hot elements combined with some very personal objects from their spell's target, their hair, blood, mementos, etc. This distinction is primarily observable in folk magic, but pertains to other types of magic as well. The no-connection theory says black and white magic are both forms of magic but are completely different from the base-up and are accomplished differently, even if they achieve similar effects. This stance is the most often one presented in fiction, including the Harry Potter series. In such books, the two classes of magic users are portrayed as being both ideologically and diametrically opposed, and separate but equal. Black and white magic are exactly the same thing, differentiated only by their end goals and intent. According to this theory, the same spell could be either black or white. Its nature is determined by the end result of the spell. And a lot of modern pagans fall into this category. So let's talk about faith healers. The term is sometimes used in reference to the belief of some Christians who hold that God heals people through the power of the Holy Spirit, often involving the laying on of the hand. The Catholic Church requires one or two miracles for the canonization of a saint, depending on the case. These are most often cases of faith healing reported as resulting from that person's intercession. Many people who resort to faith healing do so in cases of otherwise incurable disease, such as in the case of this episode with Layla. However, there are groups that believe in faith healing as the primary, if not sole, remedy for a health problem. and that we saw on the episode of House tonight. The predominant view among supporters of faith healing is that medical treatment should be sought whenever necessary, and that the two are not incompatible, believing that God can heal both supernaturally and through modern medical practice. However, there is an extreme view that teaches that seeking medical treatment constitutes a lack of faith in supernatural healing. On the flip side of the coin, there is ample skepticism by many people as to the authenticity of faith healing. Faith healing is not scientifically proven. What few controlled studies have been performed have evidenced no beneficial effect. Its practitioners can only cite anecdotal evidences of cases where it's been successful, ignoring the far more numerous cases where the patient dies despite the efforts of faith healing. Doctors often ascribe any success to the placebo effect or to spontaneous remission. Some people will heal with or without treatment, and it is generally natural to credit the most recent treatment for the cure. This logical fallacy is sometimes called post hoc ergo propter hoc. Let's see if you can say that three times fast. Okay, so let's talk about music. There was only one song in this episode, and it's one of my favorite songs of all time, Don't Fear the Reaper by Blue Oyster Cult. And the song of the night, there's a second one tonight, it's a bonus song for you. It's called Episodes, and it's by the band Pella. That's it for today, dear listeners. Sorry for the way overdue podcast. I am back to some semblance of normalcy and we'll get back on schedule. I'll post another episode at the end of the week, like usual, which will discuss Route 666. Until then, take care. Thank you for listening to the Supernatural Podcast. You can visit my website at supernaturalpodcast.blogspot.com or send me an email at supernaturalpodcast@gmail.com. Please note that the opinions expressed on this podcast are that of the host and not of the producers of Supernatural or the WB. The music brought to you tonight is from the Podshow PodSafe Music Network. Check it out at music.podshow.com.